Welcome back to Assessing and Improving Your DevOps Capabilities. I'm back here again with Sam Guckenheimer, and we're going to spend some time talking about how you can improve in your quest or your desire to become a well-tuned DevOps organization. At the core, at the heart of DevOps, is really this need for continuous improvement. And in order to improve, you have to know where you're coming from and what the path is to that improvement. And so we're going to look at sort of seven different pivots in how you can think about DevOps, seven different categories of behaviors and characteristics of a team or of an organization, so that you can identify where you are within those seven different categories and how you can think about the improvement. And I've got Sam here with me, who's going to spend some time talking to us about those different areas and how we can, how you as an organization can improve. Now, at the offset of all of this is this idea of a mental shift. How do you as an organization change the way you think about software development and think about the processes and the practices you use and make that mental transformation or that cultural transformation? And so, Sam, that's kind of the first thing I want to talk to you about, is that mental shift in moving into being a DevOps organization.
Welcome back, everyone. Gene's not with us, but we've talked about what happened in the last decade or two as we move from old development practices into Agile and then into DevOps. And I think in the old practices, we spent a lot of time thinking about validation of software, and we tended to have long development cycles, and we've moved to thinking about flow. You know, in the old days, we thought about often the iron triangle, the idea that you had a fixed amount of resources, a fixed amount of functionality, a fixed amount of time, and if you traded one, you needed to stretch the others. Or if you were a little more sophisticated, maybe you added quality. You got a shape like this, a tetrahedron, and you tried to pull on one edge and the whole thing collapsed. When we think about flow, on the other hand, we have, instead of having a rigid shape, we have something that expands, that moves through a process that's growing bigger. So one of the key enablers in DevOps is that change in mindset from validation, the old way, saying I'm going to know everything in advance and I'm going to prove it to be conformant to spec, to thinking about flow. I have a definition of done, and I have a release pipeline, and I have ways of making sure that I can pass into production quickly, and I can deliver bits into production. I can deliver reliable configurations into production through that release pipeline, and that mentality of flow, so that I can continue to accelerate through that loop. So I'd say the first key enabler is really getting into that mindset of flow. And one of the things that happens when you to make that happen as a technical practice is the establishment of a good definition of done embodied in a release pipeline.
Excellent. And when we talk about flow, a lot of times we're talking about these technical practices, or you'll hear people talk about DevOps practices. So I'm curious, Sam, and your thoughts on this around the correlation between flow and continuous integration, continuous deployment, and continuous delivery as DevOps practices.
Yeah, well, continuous integration usually means a developer checks in and that immediately triggers a build, and continuous delivery that may go straight to production and then be live. A release pipeline is an elaboration on that, where you have defined stages, and at those defined stages, for example, progressively harsher tests are applied. So you may have with a check-in, a series of unit tests. You may have a series of functional and configuration tests at the next stage. You may have a pre-production stage where you apply an hour of maximum daily load before you go live. And then you go into production when those things pass. And in certain industries where you have regulatory compliance, there may need to be a manual sign-off as you do that deployment, or there may not be, depending on what the circumstances of the case may be. So that's the sort of technical layer of it. The mindset from the customer standpoint, or from the team standpoint, is that you've now connected the team. I mean, I'll use another illustration. So if you think about developers and IT pros, and I'm using a simple little executive illustration tool. Okay. You know, the way they used to work is that they would use different processes and they'd use different tools and they'd do things with different metrics. And of course, they'd have different infrastructure because it was too expensive. And you'd get this over-the-wall phenomenon. And this was so strong that 10 years ago or 20 years ago, we had, quote, different bodies of knowledge. So this IT pro might have referred to IDLE, and this developer over here might have gotten advanced and gone on from, you know, CMMI to Agile and done Agile practices, so he started moving faster. But he'd still then pile up all this stuff at the wall. And what DevOps teaches us is that we want everyone using the same tools and the same metrics and following the same process and, of course, working off of one common infrastructure so that this wall becomes a bridge. And you can think of that release pipeline as enabling that flow, and you can think of this as a team structure where the team now has spanned from development to operations and back, and you have an information flow that's going across. So you have, of course, bits and configurations that move this way, and you have at different stages, you know, different levels of automation, and you have information flowing back. You have monitoring from production that flows back and yields information for the next stages in development. And it's everyone's working the same way. It's a simplistic model, but it's the new way of working.
And it's an effective illustration, I think, and it helps. And what's interesting about this, I think, is we've covered a lot of territory in talking about flow and the mental shift. But in the spirit of understanding how we assess and improve, metrics are very important. So I want to spend a little bit of time and talk about what are the metrics that if I'm in an organization or in a team who is seeking this kind of improvement in pursuing these DevOps practices, what are some of the metrics I would look at related to flow that I would use to assess how I'm doing?
Sure. So the first metric is cycle time or lead time. So in other words, how long does it take for an idea in development to make it into production in the user's hands on a regular basis? So I want to do something new, and that might be as small as a one-line code change, mm-hmm. Okay? How long does it take for that to get into production, okay? The next thing I want to look at is effectively the other way. If there's a live-site incident or a production event, how long does it take to get back, do a root cause remediation, and get the fix back into live users' hands? Okay, so that's typically mean time to remediate, or mean the combination of mean time to detect and mean time to remediate. Okay, and then the third thing that I want to know is validated learning. That is, how from watching over here in production what's going on in the live working system. How am I building up knowledge through observing usage, through observing patterns in the software? How am I building up the knowledge, the learning that will influence the next cycle of work in the product backlog that will determine what will flow next into the next set of improvements in production?
Fantastic. So as an organization, if I'm looking at these metrics and using them to baseline where I'm at today, then I have a position to work from to measure my improvement and see how I'm doing in terms of flow out of my development organization and into production and learning and insight from production back into my organization, which brings me to wanting to talk about a few of the other things. So if we think about flow, let's talk about what leads into flow. Let's talk about the backlog for a minute. Organizations and how they think about identifying, capturing, prioritizing, managing their work.
Yeah, so the product backlog is not a new idea with DevOps. Product backlog was the evolution of requirements and was the way Agile led us to think about the set of stuff you're planning to do, okay? And the notion was to get one product backlog, one set of stuff you were going to do that everyone shared, and that you would take to the definition of done and deliver to the customer. Now, in the days of Agile, there was this notion of an omniscient product owner. And the product owner would be the arbiter of what went in the backlog and what it meant and all that kind of stuff. And the product owner was somehow supposed to, you know, divine by cutting open a chicken and casting the entrails what the right thing to do was, okay? Instead, what we do in a mature DevOps organization is we think of the backlog as a set of hypotheses, okay? We believe that if we do such and such, it will improve retention of our customers. We believe that if we do such and such, speed up our website by this much, it will increase average order value. We believe whatever. And then, when we get into construction, we're instrumenting, we're doing that thing, but we're instrumenting that hypothesis so that we can collect sufficient data over in production to render a yay or nay on that hypothesis. Now, it may be that we're not just getting data about the hypothesis as stated. In fact, if we're doing a good job in monitoring, we're getting all sorts of data. We may have introduced some fault or some side effect that we had no idea we were going to do, and we want to get, of course, that information too. We may have a performance slowdown. We may have something that interacts differently with a third party, what have you. But the point is that we're getting data. And the data is now coming back and letting us take the next move in the chess game based on the previous experiment and that move and its results. So instead of saying we're going to hire the smartest person in the world to be the product owner, and that person's going to have some supernatural ability to figure out what the right thing to do is, we say we're going to create good hypotheses that can be confirmed or refuted by means of collecting data, and we're going to deploy the software in a manner where we can instrument and monitor and collect the data and use that data to validate or refute the hypothesis. And that will tell us then what the next step is. And if we refute the hypothesis, that's validated learning. So if we discover that we thought a particular step, you know, adding some feature would, you know, improve customer retention, improve order size, improve whatever, and it doesn't, we've just learned something. And that learning is very valuable in determining what to do next.
And I think you've hit on a couple really interesting points there. And one is, on one end of the spectrum with backlog, you think about organizations that are top-down driven. A lot of times the backlog is a matter of escalation or brute force. Whoever has the loudest voice gets their thing done. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, as you improve and you mature in your ability to execute in an efficient way, you have this culture of experimentation, and you are willing to create hypotheses, try things, fail or not fail. You've learned something and you're moving on from it, which is probably the most important aspect of all of this, and this idea, this build, measure, learn mentality of how you move forward. So let's talk about the people that do this work. For an organization who's trying to improve, one of the things we often talk about is schedule and team. How do you organize the teams? How do you assemble the people? And then how do you build a schedule so that they can get this work done? What are the planning increments? How long of a horizon do you think about? And these are questions we get asked quite a bit, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, so the team should clearly be multidisciplinary, and as Dan Pink talks about, you really want to have a group that is small enough to feel a sense of autonomy, mastery, and purpose over their own fate. Scrum taught that the magic number was 7. We found that teams up to 8 or 12 work well together. In our environment, other people have found, you know, similar results, but you want a small team that the Scrum team or feature crew that works together. We co-locate them in a team room so that they are in a physical space where they can talk to each other, with each other, where there are lots of whiteboards and things like that, so that they don't have to book a conference room to just talk, and they don't feel like they're disturbing their neighbors if they just have a conversation and so forth. It's multidisciplinary. It should include developers and operations and the product owner, who's the customer advocate. Unlike classic or original Scrum, we think that the product owner should be there in the team doing the experiments and talking on a daily basis with everyone else, and observing the site and observing the metrics and observing what the software usage itself is telling you. Now, you talked about schedule. We find that it makes a lot of sense to have everyone working on a sprint schedule. Some people advocate 2 weeks. Some do 4. We do 3. We find that works well for us. And we do those globally. So, you know, right now it's Sprint 72 in Redmond and Hyderabad and Raleigh and Cambridge, England, wherever you go, has exactly the same meaning. And it's, you know, starts on a Monday and it ends on a Friday. And we all use the same terminology. And it provides a currency of discussing schedule that everyone gets. Some teams will divide that into 1 week increments for themselves. But when they negotiate across each other, they can say, here's what I'm going to do for you in 73. There are some very mature organizations that don't do sprints, where they basically let every, or don't try to coordinate sprints, where they let every development team effectively self-manage and, you know, push deploy on their stuff when they want. Obviously, in that case, they're very highly decoupled in terms of functionality, and they don't need to coordinate across things a lot, and there doesn't need to be a lot of oversight of the bigger release. The other thing to note is that one of the technical capabilities, this is related back to release pipeline, one of the technical capabilities that helps you do this is to use something that we call feature flags, so that you can have the notion of a dark release. You can have the notion that code is going out and code stays in the master branch, but isn't necessarily visible to everyone. It might be just to the people who are working on it. It might be just to an inner circle of early users or whatever, and that you can raise or lower the flag at runtime or raise it for another team that's going to be building something in conjunction with that. And by continuously developing in this way, you have a very fine-grained control of what's out in your service. And teams work together that way on a common sprinting schedule. I think that's the majority case. I think there are some cases of mature organizations where they just, you know, say, we have enough confidence in our release pipeline, we have enough confidence in our quality gates, and we're sufficiently decoupled in all of our services and what we do that we don't try to coordinate sprints and just let teams run and self-deploy.
So I think what I'm hearing is the important thing about schedule and team is that teams are small, they're autonomous, they own their destiny. The scheduling is really about visible horizons. What can you work on that you can have a good level of certainty about what you'll be able to complete? Sprint length is, there's no perfect answer. You know, I heard you say some people do two, some people do four, we do three. It's what works right for you, I think. But the key is short iterations.
Yes.
So that you can kind of move in these quick little pieces, and you can pivot and you can course correct as you need to. You talked a little bit about feature flags, and this leads me to the topic of evidence. And feature flags are a great mechanism to enable continuous integration, so you can constantly have your code going into the mainline and being tested and being used, but disabled where necessary. There's also an aspect of this where feature flags go out into production and you're able to turn them on or turn them off for different cohorts of your user base to do some test in production or flighting type of exercises. And this leads me to thinking about evidence. And we talked a little bit about evidence as we were in the backlog conversation and how we populate the backlog based on some of this evidence. Evidence exists throughout the entire life cycle. So feature flags give me one mechanism to go out and test things and gather some evidence. But let's talk about evidence throughout the lifecycle. What are our options, and what are high performing DevOps organizations doing?
Well, high performing DevOps organizations certainly use feature flags as a progressive way of developing capability, and you can think of them as a way of exposing functionality in concentric circles. Typically, this goes back to the flow discussion, you want to optimize for very rapid code flow, so that in unlike the old days where if you were doing something that was longer than a sprint or several sprints, you would create a branch and go hide your work in that branch. Nowadays, the pattern is you minimize branches, you work in master, and hide your code behind a feature flag, which you can lift in production selectively. So you always have the capability to do this dark release and to work with other teams to collaborate and to expose things to early users and collect evidence on, hey, does this work for you. And you might get a response to the effect of, well, we love the idea, but it's clunky. And you say, okay. Now, in some cases, people just do instrumentation and try to figure out from, you know, the trace files and metrics and what have you, what the usage patterns are. We actually like to have the qualitative dialogue with those close customers as well and say, well, what did you think? And what are your recommendations and what are you missing and things like that? And then we might, what we might do is we might take that particular area and redo it and then re-expose it to the same people and say, what do you, you know, is this better? Or we might do parallel testing of versions and say, which do you like? So it's not just a quantitative issue of gathering evidence. Certainly the quantitative usage measurement is there. It's also a qualitative one where you are taking groups who engage with you and you're reaching out and you're talking with them and experimenting with them. And that, of course, informs the backlog. Everything that is testing from validating a storyboard with a group of customers to unit testing on code to functional testing on devices to load testing to monitoring in production is, of course, evidence gathering about the software, and the monitoring in production leads you to quality of service kinds of metrics about things like performance and usage patterns and what have you. And all of those you continually watch and tune. So you want to know that you're doing better on live site incidents, you're getting fewer of them, you're not, you know, getting them from the same root causes, that you're sort of improving there, that your severity's going down, that your time to remediate's improving. All of those things you track as sort of the health, and that your usage goes up, and you look there for, you know, like certainly double-digit month-on-month kinds of growth.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing from you, Sam, is data. It's about data. Using the various tools at your disposal, whether that's testing or monitoring or experimentation, to collect data so that the decisions you make about how you move forward with your product are based on data and not assumption or hunch or any other process or practice you might use to make decisions about your product. In doing all of this, we sometimes accrue debt, Sam. Technical debt is something that exists as we do these things. We make decisions, especially when we make decisions to change and do something differently. Sometimes we intentionally take on debt. We make a decision. We know the outcome is going to be work we have to catch up on later. And sometimes there's unknown or unexpected technical debt. In terms of DevOps organizations, on either end of the spectrum and in between, how do you think about technical debt? What do you see the organizations who are struggling and in their approach with technical debt compared to the organizations that are high-performing in their expectations and management around technical debt?
Well, I think that technical debt is first and foremost the greatest impediment to organizations moving to DevOps. Folks who have high levels of technical debt are simply get stuck in not having the ability to move forward into this type of continuous flow because they have this cliff behind them of technical debt. And the consequence of the technical debt is that they have all of this unplanned work that just keeps popping up. You know, oh, we didn't know we'd have these bugs here. Oh, we didn't know testing would take this long. Oh, we didn't know about all of this sort of stuff, all of this dark matter. So that is, that's the first problem with technical debt, that a lot of people are carrying high and unknown levels of debt for which interest hasn't been charged and for which the penalty flag hasn't been raised. Now, they need to get clean, and they need to stay clean. Staying clean means that there's a good definition of done, and that definition of done is enforced with automation. That automation should start with a developer with something like, you know, gated check-in, like we have, or a similar capability, so that there's high unit testing and code comes in clean, and it should be enforced through the release pipeline with harsher and harsher tests. And then the key thing is that once something is in production, you have the ability to remediate quickly. So rather than say we are going to validate everything in advance, because you'll only really be able to test for the, to use the Rumsfeld phrase, the known unknowns, what you'll get in production are the unknown unknowns, right? So you'll get the stuff you haven't seen before. And every time you get one of those, you want to remediate to root cause and put in place the tests that prevent the recurrence. So you progressively harden your software against what everything you've seen before, and it gets stronger and stronger, and your ability to remediate gets stronger and stronger. And that's the stay clean part of managing technical debt. But if you don't have that strategy of managing technical debt, you cannot achieve a DevOps culture. It doesn't work. It's a key impediment. And it's tightly related to the definition of done. It's tightly related to the automation of flow with a release pipeline. It's tightly related to the team culture.
Absolutely, I agree. You know, debt in all forms is sort of a core impediment in life, and technical debt in software development is no different. And the idea, you know, the sort of contrast and compare of a organization that needs to improve, where technical debt isn't consciously managed, it isn't addressed, and it is constantly leading to surprises and rework, and more time is spent fixing things and dealing with sustaining stuff rather than innovation, versus a high performing organization where technical debt is a conscious thing that is managed and everyone understands it. It's part of the nomenclature, and it enables you to move it at a faster pace by managing it actively. We have a couple more minutes, Sam, and I want to take the next two categories and talk about them together, which is how we think about our production environments. And specifically, we talked a little bit about some things already in terms of monitoring production environments to reduce the mean time to detection, and different kinds of monitoring that we might do and how that will inform us. And in support of that, what is that underlying infrastructure, what I like to call the metal? What, in between, on the spectrum of, very rudimentary DevOps capabilities to high-performing DevOps capabilities, what does that infrastructure look like? This contrast from every new app gets a new server to infrastructure as a service that's being provided to the organization. Let's talk about those two together, because I think they're tightly related.
Yeah, they are. So I think a sophisticated organization these days will think of itself as managing configurations and environments as code. So configurations are describable. For example, we have the technology of DSC, desired state configuration, and with it the Azure Resource Manager that describes environments around that. There are comparable things that are out in the market, Chef is an example of a vendor that's been out there as his puppet. The movement toward containerization is pushing toward these lighter weight descriptions as well. But the notion is all the same. The point is, instead of having your production system as the only thing that describes itself, you have a formal description of it that is in source control and is treated the same way source code is treated. And then that is used through your release pipeline for instantiation, and that can stand up the stages of the release pipeline. And if you're using the public cloud for this, like our Azure, then you effectively have a data center without walls. So you're not constrained by the physical infrastructure that you happen to have available at the particular time. You can expand out and stand up dev test labs on demand, stand up a pre-production environment on demand, and so forth. You can, in fact, do is stand up a scale unit for canary testing and have, you know, a strategy of data center to data center failover that we use. So it's a notion of infrastructure gets described the same way the software on the infrastructure gets described. And it's just, you know, configuration is just another form of code, and that's treated through the pipeline the same way.
Well, I think you hit on a very key topic, which is when you are able to describe your infrastructure and configuration as code, you're then able to instantiate every environment based off the same source material, which means whether I'm in a dev environment, a test, a pre-production, or a production environment, that environment all looks the same. The only difference really might be scale. My dev environment might be a much smaller version of what that pre-production environment or production environment looks like. So Sam, we've talked about a bunch of things today, and for those of you guys at home, I just want to recap a little bit. We've hit on seven categories of DevOps that are worth taking a look at when you want to think about how you both assess and improve in your DevOps capabilities. And those seven categories we looked at first were the flow of value through the system. How do you measure and then improve on how code flows and value flows through the system from the development environment out to production, and then the flow of that learning back into the development team to make improvements. We talked about the backlog and how high-performing DevOps organizations manage a single backlog that is tied to business value, and with that, this culture of experimentation that enables these organizations to test ideas and move things forward on their backlog. Related to the backlog, we talked about the teams and the schedule in terms of being small, self-organizing teams that are multidisciplinary in nature and that work in short iterations so that they can course correct frequently and move at a pretty, quote, agile pace. We also talked a bit about evidence and using evidence throughout the application lifecycle, whether that comes from test data or if it comes from monitoring or experimentation, but using the data you get as evidence to make decisions rather than making anecdotal decisions or, you know, finger in the wind kind of decisions to invest in your product. We talked about technical debt as being one of the real fundamental things you need to get a hold of and manage if you want to move forward as a successful DevOps organization and become proactive in your management of technical debt rather than reactive to what the technical debt does to you. We also talked about, Sam, just down the production and underlying metal or the infrastructure that supports your DevOps organization. And really being able to have a flexible production environment that is supported by infrastructure as a service so that I can scale up and scale down and scale out as I need to. And for some organizations, Sam, it's not uncommon to have them be dependent on an on-premise data center for production, but leveraging a cloud provider like Azure for their dev, test, and staging environments so they can be a little bit more flexible and a little bit more fluid in how those environments work.
Yeah, absolutely. The public cloud is great for that, right? You know, most of our customers do have data centers. Most of our customers were not born yesterday. So they're not brand new, but most of our customers realize that they have these variable workloads, and dev test is a classic variable workload. So it is something that lends itself perfectly to, you know, the cloud. And the idea that you can have capacity on demand, that's great. Or the idea that you want to, in your release pipeline, run an hour of peak daily load in pre-production a day, perfect. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, that's, you know, an hour a day you want extra capacity for. That doesn't mean that your production environment needs to be in the same place. It can be, certainly, but it doesn't have to be. But it also doesn't mean you need to double the scale of your data center in order to get 1 hour out of 24.
Well, excellent. So there you have it, guys. We talked about a bunch of stuff, but more importantly, it comes down to, you know, assess and build an improvement plan around flow, backlog, schedule and team, evidence, technical debt, production, and metal. That is the strategy for how you can improve in your DevOps practices and become a more high-performing DevOps organization. Sam, I want to thank you for spending the time with us and talking about this. And we're going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll be right back after that.
Thank you very much.